Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris and you're watching Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. A week and a half ago, following a worldwide surge in cases, the WHO, World Health Organization, declared monkeypox as a public health emergency of international concern. It is the highest alert that the WHO can issue. Now, the declaration was made despite a lack of consensus among the members of the WHO's Task Force Emergency Committee on the monkeypox outbreak. And while the disease has already been present in the African continent, in Central and West Africa, it was detected in Europe, North America, and Asia in May. As yet, no positive cases reported in Malaysia. However, what does the WHO's announcement mean for us? And what lessons can we take from the most recent public health crises of COVID-19 and also the HIV/AIDS epidemic? Joining us on the show now, we have Dr. Kor Swee King. He's a member of the Malaysian Health Coalition. Swee King, thank you for joining me on the show today. There were detractors who argued that the WHO was kind of slow in raising the alarm for COVID-19. And now they're saying, well, the WHO is overcorrecting in being too quick to declare monkeypox a public health emergency of international concern. What do you understand about why the WHO chose to issue its highest health alert for monkeypox?
Melissa, it's a pleasure to be back on the show. We can first begin by understanding a bit of the history of monkeypox, a little bit of the PHEIC, or some people call it the fake, public health emergency of international concern, and how those decisions are being made in order to answer your question. The first case of monkeypox was actually classified in 1970 in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And this was many years ago when the science became evolved and sophisticated enough for scientists and doctors to detect what is the virus that is causing this particular disease. In Central and West African countries, like Congo and Nigeria, monkeypox is actually endemic. What it means is that it's always present in those countries. But now, monkeypox is now detected in many countries where monkeypox isn't endemic and it's not usually found. And it's in this context in 2022 that the International Health Regulations Emergency Committee set and deliberated in May, June, and then announced a PHEIC on the 23rd of July. What is the IHR, or International Health Regulations Emergency Committee? Inside the World Health Organization, there is a set of regulations called the IHR. The IHR has a very long history, but the current incarnation of IHR was passed in the year 2005. What does IHR do? IHR classifies how countries around the world should respond to a public health emergency of international concern. In other words, it's the first attempt in 2005 that codifies how the world should react to an infectious disease or epidemic or outbreak or pandemic. So that's the group of people, the IHR Emergency Committee, who decides what is a PHEIC and advises the Director General of the WHO. And inside the PHEIC, there are four main criteria. And we will see, Melissa, that these four criteria are, there's a lot of science underpinning it, but also a lot of judgment and a lot of political judgment. These are the four criteria. Number one, to declare a PHEIC, it must be an extraordinary event. But the word extraordinary, and this is inside the IHR, by the way, the word extraordinary, and the word extraordinary doesn't have a scientific basis to it. It depends on personal judgment. Of course, the judgment of experts and not just lay people. Number two, PHEICs must have public health risk. This one's easier to quantify. Thirdly, international spread of disease, not just local or country-specific spread of disease. And number four, requiring a coordinated response. So these are actual words that I'm repeating verbatim from the international health regulations. As we can see, these four terms have some science underpinning it, but also require judgment and political judgment. Since 2009, there have been seven outbreaks that have triggered a PHEIC. Monkeypox is the latest one. Before that, we've got COVID. And we can see that they'll never be able to achieve a consensus, that there'll always be somebody who says that it's too slow or too fast, too quick or too slow, and so on and so forth. So Lisa, that my answer is just given a bit of understanding about how a PHEIC is triggered and who actually triggers it.
Well, I'm curious to get your opinion on some of the conversations that are happening about the PHEIC being triggered. Many have pointed to the fact that this reaction actually really highlights the current state of global health inequity, that, it really largely prioritizes Western lives. So the disease, as you say, was endemic in Africa, but now that it's spread to the Western countries, that now there is action being taken. Can you talk a little bit about global health inequity, particularly if we are seeing some of the mistakes that we saw during the COVID-19 pandemic with the profoundly unequal vaccine rollout, whether that might be repeated as we deal with the monkeypox outbreak?
Thank you, Melissa. I feel very strongly about this particular topic, the topic of equity in global health. What you say is very true, and let me put some perhaps more provocative words to it, which have actually appeared in peer-reviewed journals. So even traditionally conservative and sedate journals like The Lancet, the New England Journal of Medicine, British Medical Journal, they have used words like racist in order to describe the current global health infrastructure. What is the current global health infrastructure? It is where rich countries generally are making decisions. It is grant true, we can say, take it for a fact that rich countries have a lot of capacity. They have a lot of knowledge, they've got in systems and institutions and architecture for public health that actually works. However, when it comes into global health, when the, shall we say, the importance of rich countries in Europe or North America are held to a greater degree of importance compared to the needs of emerging economies or even low-income countries in Africa, South Asia, even in Southeast Asia, then we can say that there is definitely an inequality and inequity, even injustice. And these are very strong words, Melissa, but these are words which are increasingly being used even inside the World Health Organization and even within peer-reviewed academic journals, which are usually much more concerned with science and a little bit, say, afraid to tread into the areas of injustice, social injustice, global injustice, and even racism. So yes, there is definitely a component of all that into the global health architecture that makes it easy for diseases, the tropical diseases, so to speak, that have an effect on which countries to be prioritized. And when it doesn't really affect which countries, then they are deprioritized.
Are you seeing some of this play out with the monkeypox and the vaccines? We're seeing now that Europe and US have secured doses despite a number of delays, and I think the EU have bulk purchased some of the vaccines, and yet we're not hearing of vaccines being allocated to some of the African countries. How do we ensure? I mean, I think in COVID-19 there was a concerted effort to make sure that vaccines were distributed more equally, more fairly, and that itself had hiccups. What do we know about how this might play out with monkeypox?
Melissa, this is another great question where we have to go back to some of the lessons within COVID. The lessons are clear for anyone to see because we've lived COVID for the last 2.5, maybe even 3 years now. And in that lived experience of COVID, here are some observations. Number one, it does appear to everyone as a fact that rich and powerful countries are first in line for all sorts of health resources, not just vaccines, but face masks, therapeutics, antivirals, ventilators, and so on. And well, while we can understand that the rich will almost always be ahead of poor countries in the queue, this cannot stand in global health because a risk for even a poor country represents a risk to rich countries as well. One thing that we can see during COVID that our lived experience tells us that rich countries are often ahead in the queue. However, the second lesson is equally important, that regardless of who's ahead in the queue, and we may live in, to be realistic, we may be living in a world where the rich will almost always be ahead of the poor, which is why we, as a global health entity, to global health community, not an entity, and all the relevant stakeholders, including national governments, investment banks, investment funds, even pharmaceutical companies, really have to diversify and increase the production of vaccines. not just for COVID or monkeypox, but for smallpox, polio, malaria, tuberculosis, everything that you can name, we must diversify and increase the production of it. In other words, the production of vaccines cannot really only stay in rich countries, it must really be decentralized across the world. There must be more. Because India produces up to 30% of the world's vaccines, and we need to decentralize away from India as well to perhaps one country to be dominant, not dominant, but rather to be contributing significantly to different co in different continents across the world. I'm thinking maybe Brazil and Argentina, Nigeria and South Africa, India, China, Indonesia and Malaysia for Southeast Asia. We need to decentralize vaccine production so that we don't have to wait for rich countries to donate their vaccine doses to us. And finally, it's a distribution. So, firstly, it's the politics of rich people being the front of the queue. Secondly, we have to produce more of these healthcare goods and services. And then, thirdly, to distribute them equally. Here's a challenge, Melissa. We had COVAX as a facility that was created from scratch during COVID. I'm not sure that the world has enough appetite or money or energy to create a monkeypox COVAX. It would be challenging. Therefore, we, as an entire global community, may need to build and strengthen the existing United Nations infrastructure rather than create one specific COVAX every time we've got a pandemic, because the organizational energy required to create a new entity just to manufacture, procure, and distribute vaccines every time we get a pandemic will be too much and it'll be too slow. These are the three main lessons. We have to work out the politics, we have to work out a distribute, sorry, production, and finally, we've got to work out the distribution.
Speaking, do you think monkeypox is the same level of risk, or is there a risk of monkeypox to the wider global population, the same way COVID, we had to live through a pandemic for 2 years? Does monkeypox pose the same risk?
Well, we have to look at some statistics over here just to see whether or not monkeypox poses the same risk. And let me draw an imperfect example to between COVID and monkeypox, okay? It's imperfect. Why? Because the way they're transmitted is different. COVID is a lot more transmissible compared to monkeypox. COVID is almost essentially airborne or through respiratory droplets, whereas monkeypox requires you to have close physical contact with a person, touching an open sore or perhaps sexual intercourse. And that kind of close contact is much more difficult compared to COVID. But let's look at monkeypox versus COVID, okay? Very imperfect. The total number of COVID cases that we've had in the 2 years that we've encountered COVID so far is approaching 600 million cases. This is in a 2.5 year period. Monkeypox has only infected about 30,000 confirmed cases in the last 6 months or so. So when you look at this number, it will then appear to us that monkeypox will be less transmissible and less, perhaps even causing a large impact compared to COVID. But these are apples to oranges comparison, Melissa, intended only to answer this very narrow question of the total burden of disease between COVID and monkeypox. They're very different diseases. Monkeypox is about 30,000 cases, and COVID is about 600 million already.
All right. Okay. Well, Sweeking, thank you so much for joining us on the show, helping us understand a little bit better about the global response to the monkeypox outbreak. We have Dr. Kor Sweeking there from the Malaysian Health Coalition. We're going to take a quick break here on Consider This. We will be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, you're watching Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. Let's continue our conversation about the monkeypox outbreak. This following the WHO designating monkeypox with the highest level of alert, a public health emergency of international concern. This, at the time of this recording, there hasn't yet been a positive case of monkeypox reported in Malaysia. However, the outbreak has grown globally, and with that, so too has the confusion about the virus and how it spreads and who is most at risk. Joining us now to shed more light about all we need to know about monkeypox, we have Dr. Patrick Periasamy, Associate Professor Dr. Patrick Periasamy, Head of the Infectious Disease Unit at Hospital Chancellor Tuanku Muhriez UKM. Doctor, thank you for being on the show with us today. The disease, as I understand, has already been present in Central and West Africa all these years, but in May it was detected in Europe, North America, and in Asia. What is it that we know about monkeypox and how it spreads, and how it spread from the African continent to those countries, and also the spread within those countries?
Thanks for the question, and thanks for the invitation, Melissa. Actually, the virus itself is considered as a zoonosis. Zoonosis means, virus jumping from animals to humans. And it's an old disease, unlike COVID-19. And as you rightly mentioned, it's been there in Africa since 1950s. And it's a misnomer. Actually, it's detected in the virus in the monkey. That's why it got its name, monkeypox. But actually, it's been spreading in Africa, I think, especially in the Congo area since the 1970s. And 2000 onwards, they were reporting nearly 1,000 cases a year, and nobody, thought much about it. And the risk factor, as you mentioned, it's very different than what we are seeing at the moment. Those days, if you were to ask me what was the risk factor, we tell people don't eat bush meat. The biggest risk was actually get in contact with those primates like squirrels and rodents. Those was the highest risk, getting bitten or exposures to their tissue, either by eating them or getting bitten. So that's how the spread was going on for some time. And what happened in May? This year, it's still very curious for everyone. How did it actually happen? So, one theory is that it might have been spreading quietly without our knowledge. Number one, number two, this is a DNA virus, slightly different from COVID, which is a RNA virus. Why is it important to know? RNA, as if you heard Melissa, it's been mutating, and that's what they do. But this monkeypox, a DNA virus, traditionally, DNA virus doesn't mutate too much. So to answer the question, what happened in May is when they looked at this, they do studies on this spread in Europe, they found that there was significant mutation, up to 50 times. They only mutate 1 to 2 times, usually, this DNA virus. That this cohort in Europe, they found up to 50 times mutation. So are we dealing with something new? Again, the risk factor has changed now. This group, as you know, it's carrying mainly through sexual contact, especially in the gay population. So now we are focusing on the risk factor. We would say if you've been sexual contact. That is our biggest question we ask people. Second, we look at lesions, especially in the anogenital lesions. So that's what the biggest difference, yeah.
Well, Doctor, it's fascinating to think that this virus, which doesn't traditionally or normally mutate, has mutated so many times. Do we know if traditional treatments work the same way with this mutated virus?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's an ongoing discussion now. They have been trying on this group of Europe people some studies that were drugs that we were using for smallpox, some of this traditional antiviral. They are showing from a few numbers, 10 to 20, 30 patients, I would say 10, in their 20s. That's all we know so far. Showing good response in terms of reducing the lesions, reducing the amount of time the patient's having sickness. And so that's all we know. It's very early onwards, but they're showing good promise with these antivirals.
So that is the treatment. What about the vaccine? Because we've been talking a lot about vaccine inequity with the Western countries kind of buying up the bulk of the vaccine. Do we know if the outbreak can be contained through vaccine, through ring fencing, or would more mass vaccination or universal vaccination be needed to contain this outbreak?
Yeah, very good question. I think if you've seen the TV shows, people are rushing and queuing up in US for the vaccine. Yes, traditionally it's 85% effective to take the vaccine. And even if you have been exposed, taking the vaccine early into 4 days into exposure really prevents you from getting the virus. But even if it's after 4 days, even if you get the monkeypox, it's supposed to reduce the duration of suffering. So it's about 85% effective. There are two types of vaccine available. So who are the people that needs to get the vaccine? Currently, they are targeting, I think, those high-risk group, okay, especially the gay population. And, of course, healthcare workers who are dealing with these patients, or laboratory workers who are handling the specimen, and, of course, the immunocompromised group.
Right.
The other thing worth mentioning, there is also an immunoglobulin available, but has been not studied well. That was used in the previous patient of smallpox. So there are three modalities: antivirals, vaccine, and immunoglobulin available currently. But the best people are using now is the vaccine, followed up by the antivirals.
Is monkeypox a disease that is widely studied? Do we have a lot of epidemiological data on it?
Yes and no. Yes, when it was in confined in Africa, we knew how it came from. We know sort of the epidemiology. This outbreak is rather new. Like I mentioned, the mutation is slightly different. The spread is very different. It's a lot of close contact now. Close contact, those with the lesions itself. We see a lot of close contact in the family. You know, if somebody has a small monkeypox in the family, there will be an 8% risk. You know, it is, so these are slightly different from traditional risk factors
in terms of spreading. Can I ask you also, you know, I've been seeing a lot of conversation, the way monkeypox has been reported, is it accurate to think of monkeypox as a sexually transmitted disease, given that we're seeing a lot more cases within communities of where the gay and queer communities and men who have sex with men are getting, some cases of men having sex with men getting monkeypox?
A very good question. So when they studied, I think the report came out from UK, look at the first cohort of patients, the virus was actually detected in the semen. Majority of them was in the MSM population. They found the virus in the majority of the semen. The, you know, one of the presentation are rashes, and this patient had lesions mainly in the anogenital area. And you know, in this African cohort, they actually were in the face, arms, and legs. This patient had mainly at the sexual sites. So yeah, so at the moment, we know it's spreading, may spread sexually, but there's still a lot of data is needed. But the virus is found in the semen. But we also think it's because of close contacts with the lesions itself. That's why they are getting at that sites rather than the, you know, traditional face, arms, hands that we normally see.
Right. So there is a very kind of close, there is a distinction, but it's really kind of close. The WHO has already warned that stigma can be as dangerous as any virus and can in fact fuel the outbreak. What lessons do you think can be applied from the HIV and AIDS epidemic to the current handling of the monkeypox outbreak, particularly in handing out kind of health advice without the stigma?
Yeah, that's, I think, the biggest challenges for healthcare workers. I think how to make it environmental friendly for people to actually show up. I think just as you rightly said, in HIV, when it first came out, people don't show up because of the stigma. So I think monkeypox is not just spread, you know, through sexual contact. We think it's mainly close contact, and any can affect anybody, including you and me, if anybody comes with exposed lesions. So it's actually, we should make it as friendly as possible for people to appear in the clinic. Easily said than done. Just like, I think we learned something from our HIV population. So, you know, whatever we have done and learned from our HIV cohort, I think this applies exactly the same.
Right. Well, one more question from me, Doctor. I'm just wondering, even though we've not had a positive case reported as yet, what do we know about Malaysia's preparedness, our surveillance, and the outbreak response tools that we have for monkeypox?
Currently, there have been a lot of publicity from the media, such as yourself, TVs. They come up with the guidelines. There are a lot of online CME webinars that are going on a lot. I think GPs has been educated, hospital has been, guidelines has been out. So we are out of lookout for any rashes and fever that are suspicious. We have the capability to actually test the virus here. And even the private labs have stepped up and to offer services. Results are fast, you know, we are talking about 24 hours. I think we learned a lot from COVID. So I think, you know, we really wrapped it up very fast. So I think now it's just high vigilance on the doctors and patients. But we are, you know, ready-wise in terms of that. And the COVID taught us a lot in terms of infection control. So that really helped for us to prepare for this monkeypox.
Dr. Patrick Perasamy, head of the Infectious Disease Unit at Hospital Chancellor Tuan Kumukris, UKM. That wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.